Well, I'm going to get started. My name's Norman Yamada, and I'm the CTO of the Milburn Corporation, which is a fairly small hedge fund in Wall Street. And I'm going to be talking about reconciling databases using schemas, Sloan EDBI Link, PGTAP, and other tools. Just so I know what to expect, how many people here have used Sloan before? Okay, a few people. How many people here have used different types of schemas? Okay, all right. So the one nice thing that I'm seeing this year at PGCon is I think we're seeing more developments on top of Postgres, more cases of users doing weird refactorings with Postgres. And I guess my company ended up sort of walking into a whole pile of issues. And this is sort of the way that we're doing it now. And I have to say, this is really a talk given from inside the trenches. I don't think I've got necessarily the best answer to anything. It's just what we ended up doing. Okay, here's a... Wow, what happened there? Sorry. Okay, here's our basic problem. What we're basically... Yeah.
I think you could kill the lights that are shining on the screen.
Yeah, that would be great. How do we do that? Anybody technical know how to do that? You think there's like a... Is there an AV guy here? There was one. Anybody know where the lights are? Ah, yeah, there might be. Okay. These affect the screen. This says light, but I think that actually... Oh, let's see. Wow. Hold on, let's try that again. That's it's one touch button. Okay, you want to see if you can. Well, I guess we'll wait until someone comes back to assist us. Can you see it okay? It's a little washed out. I'm going to say most of this stuff because this is not exactly the deepest presentation in the world. So chances are, if you listen to me, you'll get most of what's there. The basic problem we have as a hedge fund is we're calculating financial models mostly on commodity futures. Okay, that means that almost all our applications are heavily data-driven. We use inputs such as prices, market hours, inventory levels, to try to decide whether we're going to make money, whether we're going to make models that are going to either make us money or lose us money, as the case may be. We use GNU-R, which is a, I don't know how many people here know it, but it's a special purpose statistical language to analyze our Postgres data. The issues that we have is obviously that both inputs and models can change at any time. We're collecting prices for corn. Or we're trying to get midday prices for corn in our futures markets. There's different price aggregators. Not surprisingly, the data streams that come from different price aggregators can be wildly different at times. Sometimes you can get bad data for a series of weeks. We also try to do what are known as trend-following models in our business. So we're looking at a stream of prices. Say we're looking at the last 30 days' worth of prices and looking for some statistical variation to decide what to do. Obviously, we want to change our models. So how do we test compare our changes? This is kind of the problem we have. And, okay. Obviously, if we had fairly static data or data that was coming in, we'd use the traditional solution for code development. We'd have a development server, a staging server, a production server. If we were really good people, which most of us are, try to be, but we achieve like 85% or maybe even 70% of the time, code would be developed only on the dev server. When the developer's ready, you push one change to the staging server, and then you run lovely regression tests across every single one. As we all know, this is great. This is a great model if you're lucky enough to be in a place where you don't have demands to do continuous development, and you don't have demands which are based on a continuous data stream coming in. It doesn't work in our business at all. And I'm just sort of saying that on this slide here, which is that the data that we're using, the grist for our mill, is not static. We've got price data that continually changes. We've got even our historical data streams can change. We're looking at a whole series of prices for corn, and we go back in time and we say all the prices are bad from the 80s. We've got to rebuild. And then if we're entering into a brand new market or a brand new type of instrument, usually, unfortunately, the real-time data we get back is the best way for us to start looking for patterns. Obviously, then the metadata for what we put into the models can change, like the sampling rate, the number of inputs, etc. So, I'm sort of going to beat this example down with too many times. But so basically, in our use case, this is a stupid way of looking at our universe. I'm just giving you our universe because I think it'll help you understand our problem better. This could apply to weather. This could apply to many other different issue areas. In ours, we've got an instrument, corn. Okay, it's got different, regardless of whether you care about commodity futures, and I really don't except for the case of this example, there are different prices traded in corn for contracts out there. There's a contract corn January 2010, there's one for March, one for September, whatever else. Each one has its own price stream. Corn January 2010 on a given day today. They open high, low, and settle the volume and open interest. Okay, then you can have a model that's going to hook into it. Maybe it's a very stupid model that says, well, buy the commodity if the price yesterday was greater than the price 3 months ago. Okay, those are mostly the input tables we have coming in. Now, what can change in our business is the parameter tables. If you're doing commodity futures and you're trying to synthesize out a price stream, and you got corn trading in January, you got it corn trading for March, got it trading for September, you're trying to pretend that you've got a continuous flow of prices for the contract that is 3 months out there from where you are today. So what we do is we have this table called roll schedule, which says when do we switch from one price stream for one given contract to the next. And then using that roll schedule for every synthetic commodity that we're interested in trading, we calculate the price percentage. We say, what is kind of the difference between yesterday's price and today's price? And we actually build most of our models off of that. Okay. Now, we can have, for a given instrument, a different market. Right now, let's say that we're interested in trading corn. There are some markets out there in this lovely game of financial gambling where the contracts further out are where the activity is. Some are the contracts further in are where the activity is. So we could say, we'll make more money if we trade corn not for the nearby market, nearby contract, but for the one that's 7 months out there. We regard that as a different market. It has a different price percentage stream. And then obviously for each one of those markets, we have those models. Okay. Based on those models, we calculate price percentages. We calculate signals and whether we should buy or sell. And then we can run what we can figure out on any given point in time, like how much money we would theoretically make if we went into the market and we did it exactly right and we didn't affect the market and we didn't affect it by the size of our trade or we got the price we think we ought to have had. Okay, so how on earth do we test and stage any changes to this thing? I'm going to just basically tell you this is sort of the big picture of what we do. We have three database servers, one that's production, one that's staging, and one that's development. The production, I'm going to walk through each one of the stages of this, but basically the production server replicates via Sloane to the other two servers. The other two servers have different parameter tables and different schemas, and then we can figure out the changes and the differences between the two by having what we call a chain set server over here that can track the differences between the three. We're calculating using, I'm simplifying it here, we don't have one server running GNU R against one of our database servers. We have clusters of GNU R servers because GNU R doesn't really scale well. Basically what happens when you run an instance of GNU R, it grabs hold of one core. So what you want to do, if you want to do a lot of calculations with GNU R, it's usually good to have multiple stacks of it running against the database. Okay. I'm looking for a slide, which isn't there. There's a slide here that's missing about Sloane. And I think I'll just talk off the cuff pretty quickly about that. Oh, I know what to do. Well, never mind. Okay. Sloney is one of about 5 or 6 different replication solutions that are available for Postgres. And this is not on the slides. You're going to have to pay attention for a second. There's a synchronous replication and asynchronous replication. If you want to make sure that all the contents of your database server are there on another server, you probably want to use write-ahead logging and log shipping, or something like DRDB, just to make sure that the contents of the two databases are exactly in line. Sloney and other asynchronous replication solutions, such as Golconda, which Gavin is helping to develop, Golconda, Bucardo, Londisti, and I think there's another one by Command Prompt called Mammoth Replicator. All of them allow you to do asynchronous replication. Most of them, I think all of them, also let you to do table-by-table replication. And most of them use some kind of trigger or messaging queue to push changes from one server to the other. That's the 50,000-foot view summary of Sloney. We standardized on Sloney for about 3 years ago, and I would say that it's trickier than some of the other replication solutions to set up properly. But once you get it set up, it's been pretty reliable for us. However, I want to go through some of the gotchas with it. I also want to just sort of continue to talk about what we're doing here. So in our attempts to have a dev and stage environment in our database, we're using schemas and Sloney, okay? Replication via Sloney from production server to dev and stage. Okay, Sloney provides asynchronous table replication and it blocks writes on your slave servers. If you want a multi-master, multi-slave kind of replication, you might want to look at Bucardo. I haven't used it, but I hear it does do that in some cases, though even Bucardo has issues when you've got multi-masters. If you've got a conflict in your tables, you've got to figure out some kind of rule on who wins. It's not an easy business doing multi-master stuff at all. Okay, so what we do is for the parameter tables that we said could change, we use two different schemas. Stage has a stage schema, dev has a dev schema. And then we change the search path directive to see different results. For those of you who haven't used schemas before, basically you can think of schemas as being kind of the equivalent of like paths when you're looking for files on a Unix server. You set your search path to, I don't know, stage, comma, public, and then when you select, if a table exists in stage, you'll see that table. You won't see the one in public. So that way, what we can do with our parameter tables is if we set search path to stage, comma, public, then the tables that are guaranteed to be the same in all three of the schemas, for example, the price data, which we're hoping most of the time we have a canonical price table. It doesn't matter what schema it is. We want to know the price for corn in January. It's this. That's always in the public schema. But say, going back to my example here, say that we said in the role schedule, when do we switch from one contract to the next? Let's just say that we start saying, you know what? We try to roll from one contract to the other around the 15th of the month, but we're noticing that there's a price spike in the contract right before the 15th of the month. It looks like we're getting bad data. We want to shift where we roll our contracts from rolling on the 15th of the month for a futures contract to the 10th. Does that improve our profitability? We would have a different roll schedule table in test that changes exactly where we start to switch from one price stream to another for our price percentage table, and then we would run signals against that to see whether it would improve our profit line. So anyway, what you do is you set your search path, and it works very beautifully as a kind of a masking of the tables that you don't want to care about all of a sudden in public. I'm going to stop right here for 1 second and see if anybody has a question about this, if this all makes sense so far. Okay, good. There's a bunch of gotchas you got to remember when you do a lot of stuff with search paths, when you have overlapping tables, and you can have also overlapping functions. Because we may have functions that we're using in stage that are different, have the same signatures as the ones in public, but give us different results. Oh, I see, that's on the next slide. Okay, First off, remember that when you create a foreign key constraint on a table, it's going to remember the search path of at the time that you used at the time that you created the foreign key. So that if you create a foreign key on a table in stage that refers to a table in public, and you've got your search path set to it, that's fine, as long as that's what you meant to do, because it will be written. The search path of the table will be explicitly written into the foreign key. Also, you've got to remember that as you come in, your default search path is always your name, whoever you're logging into the Postgres database as, in public. You don't want to create a schema with your name unless you really want it. Okay, this is what I was alluding to before. If you've got functions that are in one schema, during the time that you connect to that function, it caches the search path you came in with it as. So there can be this really funky business where you have this function that you've worked on, and you're testing it on, you've search path set to test, comma, public, and you run the function. And then you make a change to the function again, What you do is you've got a function, and your search path is set to test, comma, public. Fine. Then you switch your search path in that connection to be only public. And you run the function again, expecting that you're going to hit up against function only public data. But you actually get the same result as before, and you're going, what gives? I thought I should have different data in public than I have in test, comma, public. Well, what happens is as you run the function in a connection, it caches the query plan. So unless you explicitly do something inside the function to force you setting your search path, it's going to remember the search path of the first time you ran that function in the connection. So usually this bites you only in interactive stuff. You're usually not changing your search path in the middle of some PSQL function or something like that, but you've got to be aware of this. Usually what we do is if you're really trying to test a function call with different search paths, it's just simpler to do a slash C to reconnect because it clears out the caching of the query plan for the function you can go on. The other thing like this is if you're trying to create a table in a different schema that's exactly like the one that's in public, including the indexes, the constraints, and the defaults, you got to remember that your sequence that you create for the table, the default is going to... Let's say you're using a synthetic key on a table. So you got a table here, let's call it public.foo, that's got a synthetic key, foo ID sequence running. Okay, you create a table exactly like it in test, and you say including indexes, including constraints, including defaults. The interesting thing is the default for the ascending sequence will point to the sequence in public, not to test when you run it this way. So you got to remember, if I got any synthetic keys and you want to do the right thing where you have a new sequence in your test or stage schema, you got to remember to drop the default, explicitly recreate the sequence in a new schema, and you also should check the path of any foreign key constraints to make sure that they're going to the right, which table that you have in the right place. So this stuff can get kind of hairy right ahead. Oh, this was the slide I looked for. It's out of sequence. Okay. We can just move on from it. Okay, so now let's talk a little bit more about Sloney, now that we've talked about schemas and how they work. Sloney Basics, it replicates tables by basically adding triggers to the replicated table. If you're running Postgres version less than 8.3, it does deep hackery within the system catalog to make triggers kind of invisible. If you can, try to run Sloney on 8.3 and greater now. It's much easier to deal with that way. Slave node tables are read-only, writes an event log that tracks data changes on replicated table with its own schema. The nice thing is you have in Sloney this theory of replication sets. So you can have multiple replication sets, which you can think of clusters of tables that you want to replicate to different nodes. And different nodes can replicate different sets. In practice, we're not using this very much right now. We basically have one gigantic Sloney set with like 100 tables that we ship back and forth between our different nodes. But we're beginning to see there might be a use case where we have one instance where we only replicate some tables, in which case we've got to split our Sloney cluster into two different sets. The other nice thing about Sloney, which is not true, I think, of Londisti, though they will have it in version 3, is nodes can be cascaded. so that a slave node can be the cascader to feed off two or three other nodes in a chain. Okay, the Sloane gotchas. Sloane does a beautiful job of keeping a slave node in line. It keeps the sequence in line, keeps all the data in line. However, what you've got to do then is if you're making any changes on replicated tables, you got to feed it into the master node. You got to do what's known as an executed DDL script. Okay. The other thing is asynchronous replication gives you no guarantee of exactly when the slave node is going to catch up, is going to be completely in line. For us in stage and testing, it's usually okay if we have accurate price data within 5 or 6 hours, we can use it for testing. But if you're using it for close to real-time replication, this can be a problem. The nice thing about that is it works the other way to your benefit, which is that if you have a slave node that falls over, that dies, and you rebuild the hardware and you bring it back online again, it can catch up to the master. You don't have to completely rebuild your replication when you have a failure on a slave node, which is a very sweet business. But the other issue is, because of the way that Sloane pushes down changes, if you've got large deletes or copies, it can really fall behind. We have one poorly implemented algorithm on one of our simulated profits table where we basically wipe out, like, I know, hundreds of thousands of rows at once, and then we copy them back in. And usually when we have to do something like that, our slave nodes fall way behind because the slash copy on the master node is translated into individual inserts on the slave nodes or individual clumps of inserts, so it's much, much slower. The other thing is right now in Sloane, there's a huge hole which exists in all of Postgres, which is we don't have triggers on truncate. So you can block all your reads and writes. You can block all your writes on your slaves, but if some guy meaning to think, not knowing what they're doing and connected to the wrong database, which shouldn't happen but actually did happen to us a bunch of times, says truncate table, it'll just wipe out the table on the slave node, and you'll go, what the hell happened? Now, supposedly, I think in 8.4, am I right, there are going to be triggers on truncate? Does anyone know? Yeah, so at that point, this will be something that the Sloane guys can look into, or you can block it individually if you have to.
Isn't that fairly standard across database engines that there's no triggers on truncate? Truncate's pretty much wipe out, don't block.
Yeah, all I know is that if there was some way that we could just make it so you couldn't truncate at all, it'd be better for us. So, I mean, unless you really know what you're doing. Okay. There can be even gnarlier function problems with Sloane. Let's see, foreign keys on non-replicated tables that reference replicated tables must be dropped through Sloane execute DDL scripts. I think this is no longer true in 8.3. There was all this kind of crazy business you had to do with Sloane to make the triggers invisible in 8.2 or below, so that if you had a foreign key on a non-replicated table that reference, you know, I don't know, you have some table that references the contract table, and the contract table is being Sloaned all across, and you put a foreign key someplace else that says references contract. It used to be in 8.2 that if you wanted to drop this table that was pointing to a Sloaned table, you couldn't do it unless you did it through a Sloane execute DDL script. It's a pain in the butt. But I think both of these two things here, these two bullet points, are kind of not true in Sloane 2.x if you're using Postgres 8.3 or higher. Anybody else know?
Well, actually, like now, the latest version is it just ignores those foreign keys.
Okay.
So you can have invalid data that points to that data and you'll never
know. Oh, that's even worse. Okay, so that's a problem. The other thing that's interesting about this, and we're going to get to this more, because this is actually a greater problem than I just, I'm just alluding to a much bigger problem and hole here, which is that functions must be kept in sync manually. Actually, after I wrote this bullet point, I realized it's not just functions. It's triggers, it's constraints, it's views. It's anything that's not just straight the data that you're replicating in Sloane. You've got to keep them in line manually, which is why we're going to end up plugging PGTAP by the end of the hour, I have a feeling. Okay, so we've got actually three different problems that you have when you start trying to do continuous development of data in a production stage and testing environment. One, you got to reconcile the raw data, assuming that all the tables are being held equally, but your metadata, your parameter tables are changing. You want to know the differences between them, both on the inputs and the outputs. Two, you want to make sure that your raw table structures are being reconciled, because otherwise, if you add a new column to your test, it could throw off something you don't know about it. And last, you've got to, as I just said, you've got to reconcile your functions, indexes, constraints, triggers, and views. There are actually three different, very distinct problem areas. Okay, so I'm going to just talk for the most of this for the, to be frank with you, I think it's actually the simplest problem of the three, which is how do we reconcile the data between the different databases and schemas? Robert Brewer gave a very interesting talk yesterday on a potential way that you could reconcile or push changes in schemas from different databases across. My talk is really based on the idea that your schemas aren't changing very much, but your data is. Okay, here's the easy stuff. With the setup that we have, where we've got a staging server, which has got stage in public, and a testing server or dev server, which has got dev in public, it's easy to compare differences in tables between stage in public or test in public, because both of them are living in the same databases. We thought we were really clever at first when we figured this out, because we could say, okay, let's look at the simulated profits for corn, January 2009, and test. Let's compare it to what's in public. Great. Then we start realizing that what we really need to do most of the time is compare test to stage, because we're pushing databases changes that way. And we got a problem all right away, because we got nothing. We got no cross-database queries here. So what do we do? Okay. I'll tell you what we did, but before I do, I'll just point out that there are a bunch of possible ways you can go about this. There seems to be a very cool project, which I only looked at 2 days ago, called PG Comparator. I don't know if anyone, has anyone ever used this thing? It looks very sophisticated. I mean, if it works as well as the documentation, I'll definitely take more look at it. But it looks like between two heterogeneous Postgres databases, it makes a connection between the two and tries to look at the difference. Okay, inside the database, if you're doing a cross-database compare query, I basically know of two projects. There's DBLink and DBILink. We chose to use DBILink only because I used DBLink, and it was harder to remember when you use DBLink. You have to do all this crazy casting at the end to say what kind of type of column is coming back from it, so the syntax is a little unwieldy. What's DBILink? It's David Fetter's project. It's sort of an early attempt to use SQLMed within Postgres. And basically what he does is he uses PLPerlU and DBI to connect to other data sources. And then he creates empty tables and rules to make other data sources seem like different schema in the host database. It's really cool when it works, and it really doesn't work all the time. But... And it's not David's fault. He's handling a very, very difficult issue area here. I should point out that DBILink has potential, theoretically, to use any data source that Perl and DBI have a driver for. So that means that some people are using DBILink to connect to Oracle databases, to SQL Server, to MySQL, to CSV, to Excel, you name it. You can, theoretically, you ought to be able to get it to work inside here. I have some very detailed slides, but I don't think we really need to go through them in any great length. But basically what you do is you make sure that you got PLPerlU in your database, you make sure you got the right driver. In this case, for us, we need DBD Postgres. And then you run this magic function called make accessor functions. If you put your metadata up, theoretically, it works most of the time, you point in this database, you say, I got a remote schema here called dev. I want you to create a ghost schema in this test, this linking database called dev. Here's how you connect to it, and bam, it sets up all the views for you. Now, part of this is once you run this stuff, you should be able to run simple queries on remote database tables as if they're in the linked database. The only thing about it is anytime you make a change on your disconnected database, you got to refresh your whole schema because you know it's not going to know that you've changed your table. So this has a lot of caveats. The other thing about it with DBILink is you can't use indexes. You got to load the entire contents of the table into memory. And there's right now no real support for arrays or any other weirdo types. So again, I'm saying this is what we ended up doing because it was a cheap and dirty way for us to compare parameter tables. If you want to use this and you're trying to do a select some condition from a table that has hundreds of thousands of rows, this ain't going to fly. Because what it does is it brings the whole row set back into memory and then does the filtering afterwards. It doesn't know enough to use any indexing or filtering on the remote view. Okay. Well, let's gloss over all the gnarly details and let's assume that we have a very small use case here. We have a table of maybe 2,000 rows of metadata that we're trying to compare between stage and test. Now, here's the reason why we get in a jam where we want to actually do this comparison. We have in stage theoretically the stuff that's about to be pushed up to production. Test is the Wild West. We could have four or five developers doing different changes to the table at the same time. Now, I'm not defending this. I'm just telling you that this is what happens to us. Some of those changes could involve walking back changes that were already applied to stage. So you really want to, before you move stuff up, really know what are the differences between my two environments right now. Okay, how do I figure out what's changed? Let's assume right now I can look at test and stage, or not using DBI link, I'm looking between test and public, and I'm just trying to figure out what's going on. I could use except queries between the same tables and different schemas. That gets inserts and deletes. But then how do I figure out my updates? Okay, if I try to use a dynamic query that compares the contents of fields, if one schema's field has a null and the other doesn't, then it becomes very difficult to compare because when you compare anything to a null, it becomes null. So I was sort of stuck on this for a minute, and then we realized that what you can do is this is really handy row comparison function in Postgres, which is the is distinct from. When in the is distinct from, when you do a row comparison, if any tuple on the row is null and the other side is not null, it becomes false, not null. This is incredibly helpful for us because this allows us very quickly to say, essentially, are these two rows the same or not between the two? So what we do is, coming back to this, knowing this, what we're going to do is we're going to create a chain set from this row query. We can cast the row back up to the record set, and if one side of the row is null, then we need to insert it. If the left side is null, we need to delete it. If both sides have content and they're not identical, then you need to update the row. So this allows us very quickly to make a chain set. This is kind of how we run our business here. I'm going to see if I can walk through this in a way that makes this clear. This is probably the gnarliest thing in my talk, which is not that gnarly, I hope. You got test.foo and stage.foo. It's got a bar int, bars baz text. Primary key is bar int. Okay, what you're doing here is you're selecting the master row. Test is going to be master. Stage is the slave. You're joining on the primary key right here. And you're basically saying here, pull out two rows where one row is not equal to the other row. So these are everything where you've got a difference. Now, this is going to give you just a bunch of tuples, so now you've got to figure out what this actually means. Well, if you got an entry for the master row and the slave row is null, then you know you've got to insert it. If it's the other way around, then you know you've got to delete it. Otherwise, it's going to be an update. And then right here, what I'm doing is here's the row, and then I cast it back up to the foo type so that I can get out the individual fields in my surrounding query. See, now I got master row being cast as type foo, so I can say master row dot bar int baz text, all my fields are coming back out. And then obviously I'm going to rename my fields in this thing so I know which version of the field is the master one and which one is the slave one, because it could get confusing otherwise when I'm trying to do something with this chain set. So that's basically what we do when we do a fast comparison across, is we can then quickly look at all the differences here and pull out a whole collection and know that these are all the differences we have between test and stage in a given table at a given point. Now, unfortunately, we have further problems here, which is just because we have changes between our test and stage environments, not all the changes are going to go to stage at once. Some of them are, some of them will never hit stage. The other thing is, what we do is we actually create chain sets, but it's not guaranteed that we've had situations where a developer says, let me do this change to a meta table. He creates a chain set. He says, okay, it's going to get promoted on Friday. It's Tuesday. Wednesday night, he realizes, oh, I got a problem. Forget that. I'm not going to do this one. Forgets to delete the chain set. He changes the table on test so it no longer reflects the contents of what was going to be pushed out to production on Friday. So what you really need to do is, unless you're both creating the chain set and applying it at the same point in time, what you actually have to do in this cockamamie universe that we live in is that at the point that you apply the chain set, you need to verify and make sure all the contents that you have in this chain set still are there. Everybody understand this issue? Okay. So, again, this is mostly just stuff we ended up doing. I'm saying this is a homegrown solution. I'm sure there are other ways to do it. What we actually do is we take an MD5 sum of, we write out our chain set as flat text, like update table foo set the equals to this, this equals to that, and we take an MD5 of it. And then when we run the chain set, we run through the same algorithm again and see if that line actually exists as a real difference between test and stage. And what we actually do is we do a strict commit. If any line in the chain set is missing an MD5 entry in the current set, then we say something's really wrong. Let's not do any of this changes. Let's throw it out. It's possible you could be a little laissez-faire and say, if this line is bad, if this doesn't exactly exist, just throw out the line. But in practice, it's a stupid thing to do. Though we contemplated it because some of the developers were arguing with us on it. Okay. I'm going to continue to show right now how we thought we had a beautiful universe here with these different schemas and this chain set promotion and stuff. I'm going to show you that right now it's beginning to break for us. I'm going to start talking about edge cases that we have in our tables. Some of the tricks we have up to now to get it to work, but I don't think they're necessarily going to last forever. We're going to probably have to refactor completely by the time this is all over. Okay, sometimes metadata tables need to be combined or need to overlap. Okay, edge case one, you may want to add some small additions to a large table. Or edge case two, which is worse, you have overlapping conflicting data to replace records in large table. What does that mean? In our case, we want to test 100,000 new prices for a new market. There's no overlap with current data. We don't want to add it to the public schema if it's not useful. So in this case, we use inheritance in schemas. We set the search path to dev public, and then we do something pretty crazy. We alter table public.price, which is actually the canonical one, so inherits from dev.price. Why do we do that? If you're on test and you set your search path to public, you won't see the inheritance. You only see what's in public. But if your search path is dev, public, all of a sudden the inheritance works. This is very handy for when you've got, really discrete additions to the large table. And we were very pleased with this. Now, the one thing that becomes an issue here, I also want to point out one more complexity here. This means that your schema in the public schema is different on your dev node than on your public node. So all of a sudden, you have two different copies of your public schema floating around. So this is actually a problem. Edge case number two, replacing prices. Okay, you've got 100,000 prices for an already existing market. You've got a slightly different series. Some dates are accurate in production. If you try to use this inheritance trick, because it exists in both schemas, you'll get both series of prices. So we've ended up creating a bunch of custom excessive functions or views that look kind of like this. I think they're kind of ugly. Basically you say, give it to me in test if it's there. Otherwise, give it to me if it's in public and it doesn't exist in test. Don't really like it. It's what we're doing right now for some cases when we have to. Obviously, this is slower by appreciable margin. than if you're just coming from a straight price table. Obviously, if anybody else has a better solution for this kind of picket fence, actually, what we're thinking we're going to end up having to do, frankly, on this one is to partition the price table. And that way, maybe we can set up some crazy way of eliminating some partitions in certain search paths. We haven't really worked it out yet.
If you use the materialized view,
yeah.
And every time something changed in either one of those tables, it populated another table, you wouldn't have to do that.
Yeah, we're also thinking about materialized views. The trouble is right now we have, this is again a question which I guess I'll talk about some more near the end of the hour. We have a lot of triggers flying around. When a price comes in, there's a bunch of triggers firing all over the place. I think we decided we didn't want the pain of materializing that view right now. Again, it's a question of possibly refactoring. Okay, the other thing is I want to just point out, if you're using a synthetic primary key and you have two different copies of a big table, you probably want to adjust your sequences to avoid overlap. What we actually do when we have a test.price table and a public.price table is we make the test.price table sequence go negative, the other one goes positive. There are other ways to do it. You can also make it even or odd. Okay, I mentioned already that changing the inheritance of the public table will break identity of schema across nodes, and obviously it's obvious that excessive functions hurt performance. Okay, now the limitations we're talking about before, these chain sets are really good for data-driven changes, but you can't use them to promote changes in column definitions, defaults, constraints, triggers, and tables. Can't be used to promote functions and views. Chain sets can't validate trigger function equality. Bunch of problems with this. Now, I gave this talk in March and at the PGCon East in Philadelphia, and I was thinking at that time I would have a lot more to say about what happens after this. I don't, but I will at least point out some other things before I go on with these limitations. Okay, one of the limitations that you may have, that we have in ours, is inserts and updates in the public schema may need to trigger events in other schemas. We're using the same trigger function with the same trigger name to write to different tables based on the search path of the connection. And when you do that, actually what we want to do usually is we actually explicitly pass in the search path that we want to make sure we're going to at this point. We select the current setting of the search path. We store it. We then set the search path. We then do what we want to do, and then we store the search path. I don't really defend any of this. It's just what we found was necessary for us. We're wondering right now, actually, about the whole use of triggers versus messages. We could use messages and use another process to pick it up. It certainly simplifies the event handling. And other people have walked down this path before. You can use the very nice listen notify messaging thing that exists in Postgres, but it can only take a name. It has no other payload. There was some talk about, Andrew was talking about putting a different text payload, but this is not happening anytime soon now, I hear. Anybody know? Okay. There's PGQ, which Skype uses for message bus, so you can use external message queues. Gavin, you're on ActiveMQ still, or are you going to Rabbit?
I'm on Active, going to Rabbit.
Yeah. We tried using Rabbit Active. We ended up going to WebSphere, but we're looking back at Rabbit right now. Okay, so the other big issues, which I really don't cover very much in this one, is you need to figure out how to reconcile DDL. You also need to reconcile functions, triggers, views between databases and schemas, and I'm just going to quickly suggest approaches here. Okay, issue number two, which is DDL. You can try to use some sort of external application. Robert Brewer, who's sitting in the front row, gave a very interesting talk yesterday called PostFactor about sort of a version control system for this kind of stuff. The one thing that's interesting about his that may not work for us is your DDL changes are, you can't do granular DDL changes. You got to do it on the whole database as a whole. You promote it up or down. Okay, issue number three. A lot of people do this. We keep functions in source control, and we do automatic checkout and deployment. But you need to test, because these things can easily break. You need to check and make sure that all your databases have what you expect them to have. And I'm going to plug, though we haven't implemented here yet, a lot of functions that David Wheeler has done in PGTAP. Because it allows you to check your calm constraints, it allows you to check your trigger unity, and it allows you, very importantly, to test your function, behavior, and signatures. Frankly, if we had these two functions, these two tests implemented for all our functions, I would sleep a lot better at night. That all the functions exist on all the databases and the signatures are identical. We have had problems with this. And I think that's about all the stuff I have. Two other things, obviously, my company, like every other company, is looking for, with Postgres, is looking for good database administrators. So if any one of you is interested in working in New York City for a hedge fund, come and talk to me. That's really what I have. So are there any questions, comments?
Can you use Lonnie to replicate between different versions of Postgres?
Yes. That's actually one of the big great things about Selenium. It's one of the big things that people really love about it. We used to do a smooth migration between 8.2 and 8.3. We're using it now on one of our nodes that's on 8.4 beta. I guess we're not on beta 2 yet. It makes it very easy to do that, actually. So, okay. Anything else? Wow, okay. Okay, I don't have anything. Thanks. And we're done early. Okay, that's good.
So why did you end up going back or going to WebSphere? Why are you thinking about going back?
We went to WebSphere because it was much more. We had all these problems with ActiveMQ, where there was something about the way that it does a prefetch. I remember this. It was like in our case, we only had small messages going across, but ActiveMQ wants to cache like.
Well, it's a prefetch size. So you specify that in the headers.
Yeah.
So when you subscribe, you say prefetch size.
Right, but we changed this thing, and it wasn't working for us, and then we called around to get help, and the mailing list doesn't work, and we called like the people who do for fee support, and they couldn't answer it, and we just got frustrated. What we did, actually, I think what happened was that one of the developers was very comfortable with WebSphere, and they gave us a fast price, and we were in a jam. But the reason why we might want to use RabbitMQ is because I really want to use Stomp, you know, and...
And I'm actually moving to open AMQP, which is AMQP itself is a much better protocol.